right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and we're here at Studio Fist in Your Face in Salt Lake City, Utah, with another fabulous studio audience. Thanks for coming out on this happy July. I have assembled another all-star panel to guide us through our discussion tonight. First of all, to my left is the honorable... Is honorable only applied to judges or okay, the less honorable, Mark Esquire. Mark, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming back. You were on a couple weeks ago, right?
Yeah. The famous Kate Kelly discussion.
Ah, the Kate Kelly discussion. Yeah. Yes, thank you. Thank you for bringing it. And Laura is returning also. Hey, Laura.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thanks.
It's good to see you. You're always smiling.
This gotta be.
This is kind of a smiley podcast, isn't it? I usually smile, although sometimes people transcribe what I say on the internet. I'm like, oh, that guy sounds like a douche.
I'm says always laughing.
Okay, and Dr. D, with the glasses.
I know. I usually have prescription sunglasses. This is not to hide my identity or look extra cool. I'm just blind, and I'd rather see your details.
You remember in the mid-80s when it was way cool to wear those, like, auto-tinting glasses?
Yes. No.
So everybody's dad, when there was a picture taken, the flash would go off, and he was always there in the sunglasses. Yeah, that was awesome. They still sell those, by the way. If you go to Standard Optical, they still have them there.
My wife asked me if I wanted them, and I said, don't you remember back in the 80s?
Don't knock them, John.
Are you wearing transition lenses? Oh. And of course, our sound engineer, who happens to be geeking out with the... really, Charles? I'm so sorry.
Now I know one cool guy who wears them.
Cry in my beer.
My cousin and our fabulous sound engineer tonight, Charles, thanks for taking the... We need to name that seat. The mercy seat? I don't know. All right. Let's get going. Two news stories tonight. It's kind of a slow week in Mormonism. Last time I said that, all hell broke loose. But this is kind of a local story, but it does have impact on the things we've been tracking for the past 6 or 8 weeks or so. The last two Utah attorneys general, John Swallow and Mark Shurtleff, were indicted on 22 counts of all sorts of crazy shit by the FBI. Of course, I don't think the state of Utah would have ever brought them.
I thought it was the reverse of that. I thought it was the state of Utah did, but the FBI did not.
FBI actually doesn't bring charges. The FBI just arrests people. The FBI was involved in the arrest. The interesting part was it's the Department of Justice that was not arresting them, which is
a
surprise. Yeah, they passed on it. And the district attorney's office had to do it because the other folks at the attorney general's office had a small conflict.
Okay, that's good to know. Somebody put this rubber band back here. I always play with it. All right, so I'm not the biggest. Maybe I am the biggest geek. All right. The reason this is interesting to us is John Swallow and Mark Shurtleff are both active Mormons, as they will tell you very clearly and openly. And part of their power structure has been an open play on those inside ties with the church for the past few years. So as corruption sort of, not that they're full-on church insiders, but they're definitely in the power ring. And the question on everybody's mind now, since we have been notably excommunicating people, is, are they going to be excommunicated? Now, the first thing that the church says, or the statement that I read in the Tribune, they were quoting from the church handbook, which basically says, we don't do this until the state is done. And even then, we might give them room for appeals. I really honestly doubt that the church will excommunicate either one of these guys.
No, I think they do things like that when they want to distance themselves from activity, and I don't think financial – there's been a lot of financial people who have taken loads of money from people, kind of white-collar crime, that have not been excommunicated. I think it's when you get a pedophile, when you get something that doesn't look so nice. I think that's when you
– Well, then let's be clear what most of the – you know, so I was contacted and said, hey, there were 10 women who are part of the, like, feminist movement who have been – had their temple recommends taken in the past week, and I was debating whether or not to add a story. I didn't, except I just mentioned it. but let's face it, 90% of excommunications are the church, local church leaders bullying people around for, like, you know, fucking around on a date.
True.
You know, it's not, it's like most people, it's petty sex crime.
True, true.
And crime. Let's.
It's not, yeah, that's not a crime.
A crime. Only if
is
you're doing
that
it wrong.
Is that something petty sex? I got.
There can be petty sex, but it's not petty by definition.
Okay.
All right. Okay, so our next story, I read in the Salt Lake Tribune this week that there was a study. I didn't write if it was by Pew or whoever, but of all religious groups, Mormons have the lowest approval rate of our President Obama, coming in at a dismal 18%. 18% of Mormons give President Obama a favorable view. Okay, so there's a couple things it could be here. Let's assume, I know what you're all thinking. Let's assume that Mormons aren't all racist. Well, Obama did beat the Donny Osmond of Mormon politics, and that still stings a little bit, right?
Well, do we have the number for Utah on its own? I wonder if they spread that out. They said Mormons and then Utah. I'd be curious.
No, because the article I read actually compared the highest religious group approval rating for Obama was Muslims. Which I'm sure has people heading down to their bunkers
now. I knew it.
it was the Muslims and the Mormons, you know. Mormons are staunchly Republican, although the article did suggest that I think it was 60% of Mormons identify themselves as Republican. And I think they gave a number like 15 or 14% who identify as Democrat. Geez, that would mean a lot of Democratic, I mean, just statistically here, a lot of self-identifying Democrat Mormons would have to have a disfavorable view of Obama here. I don't know. I don't know if it's, they just don't like any Democrat. They don't like
it's interesting.
People born in Kenya. I don't know what it is.
For the most part, I would think that depending on how many of those came from Utah in this area, at least, It's hard to notice and say life really sucks over here because Obama is president. It's hard to put your finger on any kind of item that their lives would be directly touched by him.
Well, anything that goes wrong in your life is Obama's fault.
Wow.
Don't you know that?
Well, it's been 10 years for me, but when I was
still
going to church.
I see the temple video with Obama coming up. He's like, you can buy anything.
I was still going to church, I was surprised, especially the last couple of years, how often little slights against the Democratic Party or against Democratic positions, not even ones that are moralistic. I mean, you can argue that something like abortion is moralistic, but I was surprised how often in Mormon church you'd hear just slights at nominal stuff from the Democratic platform. So there is a culture of hostility towards Democrats in the church, in my opinion.
For sure.
I agree.
There's some talk in the news this week also that the Democrats are trying to get Mitt to run yet again. It'd be interesting to see if he goes for
it. The Democrats are?
No, the Republicans. Sorry.
No, I think
it does make sense.
It makes more sense.
Maybe the Democrats too.
That'd be fun. It was a fun time when Mitt was running. go for it. Yay.
John Stewart would love it.
Yeah, yeah. That's really the best they can come up with. All right. Well, whatever. Okay, that's our news.
The Mormon Expression Podcast is a listener-supported production. Visit our website, mormonexpression.com, to tip John's swear jar, or become a subscriber and help keep the show running. Thank you very much. We can't do it without you.
All right. Well, let's get into our main topic tonight. This is actually, I retreaded a presentation I gave at the Sunstone Conference about 3 years ago, talking about the prosperity gospel. And I'd referenced it a couple of times in the podcast, and people said, I don't know what you're talking about. And I realized I'd never talked about it on this podcast here. So here you go. We are doing it tonight. A few years ago, I heard a review of a book that was on the radio, and the authors had done a study of criminals. And what they really wanted to know is what motivated them. Like, why did they do what they did? And the authors came to one conclusion that was common across all different types of crimes, from petty crimes to large crimes, was that every one of them had a strong sense of entitlement. They said that was the unifying factor. Because the criminals, the people who were committing these crimes against society, of whatever nature, felt like society owed them something. Or they were inherently owed something, so they could go take what was rightfully theirs. And the rules didn't apply them because of that strong sense of entitlement. And it's that strong sense of entitlement that I kind of want to explore tonight, because it's what plays out in this. The prosperity gospel is a common, this is not an LDS concept, although we'll talk about how Mormons love the hell out of it. It's also called, the prosperity theology. And it's something that really rose up, among evangelicals and other charismatic Christians, mostly in the 20th century. And it took root early, but it really exploded after the war. And, it should be pointed out that not all evangelicals and Pentecostals and sort of grassroots Christians buy into this, but a lot of them do. You see it play out quite a bit in the mega churches and the McMansions, and this sort of love for money and what money can buy mixed in with Christian theology. And that's sort of what it's about. So if we go back and look at the roots of it, we have what's commonly called the American Dream. And you can go back a long time. What are those little novelettes that came out in the 19th century? Radio. There was like, there were all these little, and people are yelling at their headphones right now because they know the answer. There was this idea of rags to riches in the United States, right? That anybody could come here, land on Ellis Island, go work really hard, and they'd be rewarded with riches and with prosperity, and they would achieve the American dream. And the American dream was this, in juxtaposition to what was going on in Europe, where a lot of the money and even the guilds and the working classes and where you were in societal stratification was locked in by generations. And there was little social movement because there was little chance, if you were born on Cheapside, of going and, you know, buying a cattle farm out in the boondocks. It just wasn't in the cards. Now, we could argue about whether it's really in the cards in the United States or not. But the idea was there that you could go west and you could get property and you could build yourself and be a self-made person. And we still repeat this meme. And we love the idea of these guys that started out in their garage tinkering around with circuits and suddenly they're billionaires.
Well, that's the whole Gold Rush show. Almost any show on Discovery that deals with Alaska, it's people escaping from something and trying to make their way, and we all cheer that on. We all encourage it. And then I heard somebody talking about it today, so much so that if you're really poor and life isn't treating you well, you still wouldn't like them to tax the rich people because someday you're going to be there.
Well, this has been pointed out as sort of the Republican ethic, and the people will point out that the more liberal elements – who might, for, let's oversimplify this, might talk about more redistribution of the wealth models, right? So higher, say, inheritance taxes. That'd be a redistribution model. That when you get to the edges of the bell curve on both sides, that people who have less money are for these things. And then people who have a lot of fucking money are for these things. It's this middle class that oftentimes is most about enforcing the structures that protect wealth. And people have written a lot saying, because this sort of Republican middle class believes that they are going to achieve this higher class. And so they want the structures in place. You see the same thing in, corporate world. The people who enforce corporate culture the most are the lackeys.
Yes.
They're not the people at the top. They don't care. You know, it's the ones who are hoping to get that corner office themselves. Now, you could argue that people in the corner office were lackeys at one point, and that's when they enforce the system, and they know how to get there. But you see this enforcing of that dream of, oh God, we can all be rich. We can all have all this stuff. So that's one element. This drive. And I've actually heard it argued, not very convincing to me, that there's a genetic disposition for this. Because you had to have the balls to jump on a ship and leave Europe and come to the New World in the first place. And the argument is that sort of selected for people who are more that way. This is like the argument about cats today. Have you heard the argument about what we're doing evolutionarily to cats? You know, kitties? Meow?
No.
Are we ruining them?
We're ruining them because with the rescue culture we have, what we do is we take the most docile ones and we spay and neuter them before they can reproduce. And the ones that reproduce are the feral ones. And then, so what we're doing is we're taking the most calm ones and we're removing them from the gene pool and we're letting the most aggressive ones keep going. So there's an argument that we are selecting cats for behaviors that we don't like.
Interesting.
Europeans would say we did the same thing with Americans. That's why we're all douchebags, because we selected for these bad characteristics. Okay, so that leads to the second idea that kind of fed into this, the idea of American exceptionalism, which is all over in Mormon theology and all over in the Book of Mormon. This is the idea that America is super special, that we are different. We're better than everybody else at everything. And
I see this parallel you're kind of drafting here. The Mormon, and yeah, you can definitely see a similar thing there.
Oh, for sure. I would guess that if you went to Rome in its height, there was Roman exceptionalism and the British Empire at their height. And so it's not like Americans are super exceptional with this. But because America's geographic isolation and its natural resources, you know, and we had time to not have been, you know, invaded as often, you know, who's going to invade us? The Mexicans or the Canadians? We're pretty safe on that front. So America gave rise to this idea that we're super duper specially special.
But Mormons made that like extra. They went the extra mile on that.
Well, Mormons, and we'll get to this more in a little bit, but you're exactly right. What Joseph Smith did is he took these ideas of American exceptionalism and he dropped them in scripture, right?
Yeah.
And that's what makes the Book of Mormon unique. And it's one of those elements that people outside the church read the Book of Mormon and say, you got to be kidding me. This is 19th century writing, because the idea of American exceptionalism did not exist in any sort of Judaic tradition, right? But it literally is American exceptionalism, you know, of this place right here.
But that's how true it is. I mean, because they saw today. They knew it.
They did. Well, they saw today up until the time Joseph Smith died.
Right.
But until the time he wrote
needed.
The book, and then after that, they got a little foggy for some reason. I guess everything interesting happened before 1830, right?
Totally.
Nothing after that was noteworthy of revelation. All right. So post-war, we have the birth of this doctrine. You see, Pentecostalism really reinvents the whole idea. And Pentecostalism is, by most accounts, the fastest growing religion in the world today. Was born in the San Francisco area in 1914, when the founder of the church predicted an earthquake. And it's just grown like mad fire since then. I mean, we're talking like 100 million converts a year. And it's kind of scary. It's kind of a scary little religion. But you have like Oral Roberts. These type of guys who started out as itinerant faith healers, and then television came along. And suddenly they were on television, they were asking for money, and they were showing trappings of money. And trappings of money became a sign of religious success. The probably the person that everybody knows most closely associated with the prosperity gospel is Joel Osteen. Is that how you pronounce the name?
Yeah.
Osteen?
Osteen.
Good looking guy. My wife loves him.
He full-on embraces this merging of faith and sort of corporate motivational speaking, you know, the kind of things they would normally, you know, give in Fortune 500 companies, and Jesus Christ. I have a quote, question here. Some of your critics say that your so-called prosperity gospel isn't in keeping with the traditional Christian message, which has often been suspicious of material wealth. Right? Well, fair. How do you respond? And Joel says, I believe that God's dream is that we be successful in our careers and that we be able to send our kids to college. I don't mean that everyone is going to get rich, and I preach a lot on bloom where you're planted, but I don't have the mindset that money is a bad thing. So the fundamental idea of the prosperity gospel is, and it really shows up in the Old Testament, you know, with Abraham and Joseph, and later even with Job, that God presents material wealth to the people who follow him. Now, it makes sense in the Old Testament, because in the Old Testament, there's no afterlife. That concept is completely missing. So if you don't believe in resurrection, then, and God loves you, well, God's going to manifest that by giving you shit, right? What else is he going to do? He's going to give you women. He's going to give you cars. He's going to give you cash. He's going to give you drugs. Slaves. Right? He's going to make you live like a rock star, because that's all there is. But this is where it gets kind of interesting, this whole idea, because you're merging it with this eternal life. And whenever you have an eternal life, whatever happens here is so finite that I guess that's why people have problems with the prosperity gospel. But the people who buy into this love it, especially if they've already made their money and then gone to church. Because the pastors of the church can easily say, suddenly they're getting a lot of tithing in, and it's easy to stroke the ego of said, you know, millionaire. Oh, you know, it's indulgences again, right?
Well, it feels a lot like an MLM in a sense. You want to follow a successful person. I remember a lot of churches going into them, and if they're small, a lot of times they were led by somebody who wasn't charismatic and didn't have the income. But when you see somebody that's doing good, it's just an easy physical sign. It really is that God loves this guy. And I want God to love me in that way.
Yes. I want him to love all over me in that. All right.
It's a lot more comforting than calling people to repentance too. Instead of talking about guilt all the time, they're talking about success and happiness and blessings. It's a much more comforting gospel.
And it's a great model for running a mega church,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And if you go to those mega churches, they're fascinating. I mean, they have coffee shops and they're cool. They have like light shows and bands, and especially as Americans are more and more losing their connection with traditional religion, this is taking up that gap. And rather than this self-sacrifice, this Puritan ethic that was at tension in the 19th century, it's, hey, we're Americans. We go to Walmart and buy lots of shit. Isn't this wonderful? Aren't we great? And it's a self-justification there. There's one other historic idea I want to explore a little bit before we start talking into Mormonism, and that's the divine right of kings. And I think this was born, it's probably been around as long as there've been kings. But it was a really prevalent idea in medieval Europe with the tension between the church and the state. The basic idea behind the divine right of kings is that royal authority is divinely vested because God is in charge and God knows who the king of England is. And if God didn't like the king of England, he would kill him. Since God hasn't killed the king of England, he therefore has God's endorsement and is divinely given his right to rule. This was a widely accepted idea for a long time, and it's still around. You'll still hear it kind of bleed through different things, in like who wins wars and all this stuff. Whenever you have a God who's supposedly in charge and things are the way they are, this is a throwback to our Voltaire discussion from last week, that when God is in charge and God presumably wants this world to be a good place, whatever the world is a making of God's will.
Same reason President Benson hasn't died yet, because God doesn't want to take him, right?
The divine right of kings is alive and well in Mormon theology, right? And there's a, if you start thinking it through and you say, oh, well, this guy got cancer and this guy got run over by a train because God wanted the third guy in line to be the president. It's kind of a little weird.
It's very weird.
Well, it makes sense when you look back at, the president, that prophet that was there for like 2 weeks.
Hunter.
So Hunter's there. And his was, I think he did a few temples or something. I just remember the scramble to say, why was he there at that moment? Because it was so short and so brief, there had to be a reason. I'd have to look it back up to see what the reason was, but it was a hard one. Was it temples, the mini temples, or just, okay, so he listed a lot of temples. Obviously, they weren't built.
My favorite, Hunter moment is he did, in his short reign, he did go down to like South America, like Mexico City. And there's this thing I saw in the news where this buxom local woman breaks through the security line, and he's in a wheelchair, right? And she comes and plants a big kiss on his head, but she comes at him.
Motorboat?
And then he had this big red lipstick mark on his forehead, on his, you know. And he just looked the happiest he'd probably been in years. All right, so we sort of established the American roots of the American and European roots of this idea of the prosperity gospel. And I want to make clear that this is not a uniquely LDS thing. This is all over, especially in Southern Christian thinking. Let's talk about the genesis of this in Mormonism. First of all, we go to Joseph Smith. And Joseph Smith, before he published the Book of Mormon, was treasure digging, right? He was looking for money. And no one disputes this, right? This is, because there'll be people who, well, they probably haven't made it this far in the podcast, but there's plenty of Mormons who will deny all this and say, no, you're making shit up. No, this is widely acknowledged by everybody. Everybody except you in the church that have kept ignorant and in the dark. So Joseph Smith, the pursuit of wealth was a strong endeavor by his family from the early days. And so strong that they would use, I was going to say black magic, but that's...
They called it that, didn't they?
Michael Quinn calls it magic. It was folk magic, essentially.
Folk magic.
Yeah, that sounds softer.
Yeah. So he was literally chasing the American dream of wealth by digging in the ground. And they were on the frontier. And they kept moving to stay on the frontier. And after the church was formed, they kept moving to pursue the frontier. They were always going out to the edge of civilization. And that idea of building a new Zion, of building wealth, was there. We'll return to that in a second. So that's the first one, that Joseph Smith, from the very get-go, had no problem with wealth. And I sometimes chastise other ex-Mormon critics for criticizing the church on its pursuit of wealth. And they usually use standard Protestant theology to do so. And I say that's kind of a chicken shit move, because Mormons have always loved money. You can't criticize them for pursuing money as somehow not being true to the gospel, unless you're like a Methodist who's trying to convert people. But if you're an atheist and using Methodist theology to criticize the Mormons, you're playing a bullshit game. That doesn't work that way. And Mormons have always loved money.
I love money. I have always been a fan of it, and it always felt like God was—that's how He gave it to me.
It was
by going to church.
I can prove to you I don't love money because I don't hang on to it very long. I trade it for goods and services.
That's a good thing to love.
All right. Okay. So the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon has the prosperity cycle in it. And what's funny is the Book of Mormon basically argues that the accumulation of wealth is inevitable. If you read the book, it once again goes to the idea that the Mormon God is really a big dick, because he's created this world in which you inevitably, if you're righteous or good, you're going to get money, which is going to turn you bad. I don't know why he does that to people, but I guess he thinks it's funny. It's like the Super Bowl for God. Plus, he gets to use the dark-skinned people to chastise the white-skinned people, which is, you know, like the big game. All right, so the Book of Mormon has the prosperity cycle built right into it, the idea that righteousness will lead to material success. It says it over and over and over again. And the Book of Mormon implies it's a universal law, that it's immutable, that it's just part of the fabric of the world.
But it usually does say, I mean, they do say, yes, you get it and you get this, but then you can cross over the line. And then you're in trouble. And I think that's the justification of it. you know, I use money just to take care of my needs. Should I love it too much, I'll fall like these dudes.
Well, I think you're exactly right, because I was contemplating this last week. What is the mission, the message of the Book of Mormon then when it comes to prosperity gospel? Because it seems to say this is inevitable. And, but I think there's an implied tone there. If you're really super duper righteous, then you break out of the cycle.
Right. Oh, totally. Totally. I think it's like, in Elder Bednar's talk that he gave, I can't remember if it was this last conference or the conference before, he gave it on tithing, and he just kept tapping the brake saying, well, it's not always that you'll be healed. Well, it's not always that you'll have financial. And he used all these kind of weasel words, but the bottom line was, wink, wink, you know it blesses you. And even though they use that language.
Okay, so the next thing we look at in the early stages of Mormonism is the building of Missouri and Zion. And we're talking about 1831, 1832 Missouri. And, you know, people talk about building the temple again in Missouri, in Jackson County. And it's one of those things that the truth is conveniently forgot. Joseph Smith did not want to build a temple. He wanted to build 24 fucking temples in this huge block. And when you go to the temple lot right now, it's a big filled with all these weird churches around it. That's only just a little small portion of the place they were going to build. I mean, these guys had delusions of grandeur, right? They were going to build a big, enormous place. And the reason that the Missourians and the Mormons eventually came to blows is the Mormon rhetoric was really blown up there, that they were going to come in with all these people, and it was going to be us or them. And, of course, Sidney Rigdon's famous salt sermon basically said that. It's either you or us, so the Missourians said, well, it's us. I don't. The Missourians were douchebags too. I'm not like on Team Missouri. This was the frontier. Okay, so they were building this kingdom of God to slide into the millennial age, and this is a key important understanding of Mormon theology. That for a lot of Christians, they're waiting for this rapture, and then God is going to come and cleanse the earth. This is not Mormon theology. Mormon theology is we start building things now. And so when critics criticize the church and say, why does the church need malls? For the same reason it needs cattle farms and underwear plants and tuna boats and everything else the church owns. Because they need the whole fucking system. They like the American way of life, and they're here to build it so that when Jesus comes, they just hand him the keys. That's Mormon theology. And when people criticize Mormons as being hypocritical, I know I'm circling back to my point, but God damn it, it's a good point. When people criticize the Mormons as being hypocritical, they're not understanding Mormon theology, because this is fundamental to Mormon theology.
Amen. There's the amen for
Thank
you.
Thank you. Thank you.
You posted an interesting thing the other day about there. Some guys decided to develop back at Independence at Adam and Iam, and he's encouraging people to move back before the prophet tells them to, I guess.
Right, with religious, they bought up a bunch of land. Now, Adam on Iam, so Independence, Missouri is about, the temple lot is about 15 miles outside of Kansas City. And Adam on Iam is 45 minutes into buttfuck from there. And it's out in the middle of nowhere.
It is. Right. I've been there. I sat there and said, wow.
I'm curious.
This is where life started.
The garden was
are there
right
trinkets?
Here.
Are people selling things there?
No.
There's
just a field.
Nobody's capitalizing on
there's
this?
There's an old apocryphal story, and I can't remember where it comes
from. Nobody's like selling little lots, own a square inch?
That there used to be, because Joseph went to Spring Hill, and he said, see this pile of rocks here? That is the motherfucking altar where Adam sacrificed to God, and it's been here through the flood.
Amazing.
You didn't add that part, but I added that on for dramatic effect. All right. But the story was that the stake would go out there every year and rebuild it because people would take the rocks, you know, because then they could put it on their mantle and say, you know what this rock is? I don't know if Spring Hill still has. Anybody been out to Spring Hill? It's too far in the middle of nowhere for me to go to.
I've been there. Where they've got the cornerstones of the temple, and you can look over and see Adam on Diamond.
Well, Adam on Diamond's like 30 miles north of that.
But you can like look over and see it kind of? No.
I suppose if you look over a long way. I don't
know. A nice elder told her this.
Yeah.
A little tour guide.
There's nobody there.
There's nobody?
Oh, no.
So you were on the temple.
You just
read
something and that's it.
Yeah. And you've got the reorganized temple, the spiral.
That's somewhere else.
That's down on this corner. Then on the, I'm So people listening at home, I'm gesturing with my hands, so bear with me. They're on the south side is the LDS Visitor Center across the street. And then the temple lot, people own stuff up here. It's mostly like a big grass field. Because no one wants to build a temple there and then prove that their religion's not true. It's always true in potentiality. All right. So Kirtland and Nauvoo. So that's Zion and that failed really quickly. The Mormons were all run out in 33 and 34. So we go up to go back to Kirtland. Joseph Smith never wanted to stay in Missouri, right? He set a colony down there, and they were all of the New York saints who had sold everything they had, and they were kind of poor, and they didn't really want them in Kirtland, so they shuffled them down to Missouri. And then we all came back. So Kirtland was a lot of speculation, and that's what ruined the church there. They were speculating on currency, they were speculating on property, and the bank failed. And so we still have this whole idea that they were selling property and they were very much involved in the economic stage. Took a breather, then went into, in 39, bought the property for Nauvoo and started again doing this thing. And what's funny is if you read the accounts, one of the things that was a dispute is there was the upper city and the lower city. Of course, as people were all dying of malaria, suddenly the upper zone outside of the floodplain became much more desirable. But like Joseph, if I remember right, the church owned property down here that they were selling, and Joseph owned property up here. And he started like funneling people away from the church lands. And the church was supposed to sell these properties. That was the way they were financing the church, is they were counting on a whole bunch of immigrants coming in and buying property from the church. So the church itself was involved in land speculation. But so you get all these like general authorities who are competing against the church that they're working for, and it starts pissing a lot of people off. But the point is that Kirtland still had this whole God, religion, money, economics, it's all one big whole. We'll circumcise it into all one. Is circumcised the right word?
That's cutting off.
Circumscribed.
That's not adding to.
I fell asleep sometimes. I can't help it. It was warm in there.
There's a great book that's just come out called The American Crucifixion that is highly recommend if you haven't read it. And it talks about all of this that's going on right at the end of Joseph Smith's life. And the interesting thing about it is, you know, after all of that time that he was trying to get money through gold digging and other things, he was spectacularly unsuccessful in doing that. The only way Joseph Smith made money was through selling religion.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and.
Or leveraging religion, perhaps.
And it did cost him eventually.
Yeah.
So when we come out to Utah, they lay the land out, they partition the property. There's some great early maps of Salt Lake City, and you can see how they awarded the 12 and the leadership with land. And then, of course, you couldn't open any business in Salt Lake City without Brigham Young's approval. So if you wanted to say, go log Little Cottonwood Canyon, you'd have to go supplicate to Brigham Young to get the rights to that. My point is not to criticize the economic system, but just to point out that it was there, and then the idea of prosperity. And oftentimes, and this still continues, today you see honor given to those who are financially successful. For example, you know, a lot of the members of the 12 today are former lawyers and executives. Ballard was a car salesman, very successful one. So,
I have some interesting stats on that.
I paid
my daughter to set up a spreadsheet for me, and she went through the current general authority makeup and went through.
What are we defining? Are we level 1, 70?
No, we include everything on the sheet. So this included now women.
Oh, this is from the centerfold?
From the centerfold.
Okay.
So this is centerfold stats. By the percentage, business was 76%. Just being involved in business, followed by finance. So you could kind of count that in there just as the biggies there. But it's labor was low down on there. There's one, three athletics, apparently. My daughter said one of them had been in the NFL. Is that right, Taylor? Yeah. Okay. So it was very interesting. I mean, you have all of these educations, and obviously everybody is super white. They're super involved in business. There's no African American. There's four from Africa. And the, it's, and the interesting thing also is degrees. As you get into the higher ups, into the, obviously the 12 and that, you get a lot of honorary degrees. So that's a nice benefit.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, if you were to look at this and you said, this is the makeup of my board, you'd be very happy with the financial stability of that company.
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure. Okay, great data. Thanks. So the last thing I wanted to talk about is doctrinally the concept of stewardship, which is one of those code words in Mormonism, like counsel. You all know that counsel means you were told to do something. So when you read a press release and the church says we counseled such and such, then everyone says, oh, you gave them some advice. That's not what counsel means in the church. And stewardship means that you're given, it's really the same idea as of management in the United States. You're given control over something and you're expected to make it prosper. You're expected to bring in money for your upline, the overlord, right? And, that concept of stewardship emerged around about, you know, the Nauvoo, especially in Salt Lake City. By that time, because the immigrants were coming in, they were being flagged out to the different areas and, you know, told, we want you to do this. We want you to bring this crop in. So the communities were oftentimes set up around a specific quote unquote stewardship. And you were sort of ranked on how well you did that and how well you brought in property, on the 5-year plan for Moscow. I think I got my wires crossed.
So this is also like the law of consecration.
Yeah, yeah.
The United Order is what they call
it. Yeah, that's what,
right?
I was going to ask is how do you see the United Order experiment as fitting into this whole?
Well, one of the problems that this is a whole podcast in and of itself, but the church itself, they're going to blame the people. I'm going to throw down. They're going to blame people right now and they say, oh, people were too selfish. The church screwed up consecration from the beginning because they had immigrants sell everything they had, and then they would get in debt to the church to come over on the perpetual immigration fund. And then the church would not excuse their personal debt. So they would say, you're consecrating everything you have to the church except your fucking debt. Go down to San Pete County and you still owe us $800. So what would happen is people would say, the bishop would say, it's your turn to go out on the stake farm. And the stake farms were 50, 60, 70% of the property at the time. People had their own little lots, but then the big lots. And people would say, I can't go out on the stake farm. I owe the church $800. I need to go gather timber for this timber company, or I need to go work down in the mines. The church itself fucked the system up because they would only play consecration from their benefit. If they really believed in consecration, they'd say, welcome to Zion. Your debts are forgiven. You're part of the collective. Go work, comrade. But they wouldn't do that.
It sounds like coyotes who bring you in, keep the debt on you. That's interesting.
But doesn't that argue at some level that the church isn't as focused in those days on prosperity, that they actually experimented with essentially a communistic or socialism?
Well, I think that they were focused on prosperity, but prosperity for the upper echelons. I hate to get into class warfare, but, you know, I look at a lot of things that Young was doing, and he accumulated a massive amount of wealth in a few short years from literally living in mud huts. The amount of money, you look at when, if you go into Salt Lake and look at when he was doing a lot of the building, we're talking late 50s, early 60s, and knowing that the first 10 years that the church was here was really poverty ridden. The church never talks about the fact they shut down immigration the year later for about 3 years after 47 because there was just no food. There was no money. There was no nothing. And so we have this big idea of this, all these people trekking across, but it took a while to gain footing. And all during this time that everybody's suffering and living in dugouts, you know, go read the history of like what was going on in Logan. These guys were living in mud up there, you know, when it's 10 degrees below zero. At the same time, Young's building mansions in Salt Lake City. Sorry, I'm on a diet.
But I think that points out how this prosperity does have to work. I think you do need those people who are not succeeding. You've got to have, it's a great belief to sell. We will be blessed. These things will happen eventually. And you have to have that hope when you're sitting in a hut and all the grasshoppers ate your corn. You want to hope that there's something out there.
Well, yeah. And I think Young had this ethic and he established it early in Utah that the people who were financially successful would then become big church leaders. Great example is O.C. Tanner. You know, where you, and you go through Salt Lake and you see some of these big names on these buildings and you're like, oh, well, I've heard that name in conference. Yeah, you have. And it usually came not because it came, the money came first and then they were rewarded with church patronage. Now, sometimes in the old families, like the Hinckleys, then they had both going simultaneously. You know, they had their hands everywhere in money and it's been inseparable. The Smiths, we need to do a lot of podcasts on the Mormon dynasties. They're endlessly fascinating. And they always get, thrown off by the guy who needs to inherit the money is often into buggery. So that's what brings it down. Okay. You can scratch that. Editor, you can, now you won't. All right.
Buggery.
We need to bring back that term.
Can you define that?
It is a good
that?
Word. It's exactly what you think it means. All right. So Mormonism today, man, it's hot in here. I'm going to turn the.
You have a beautiful glisten on your head, though. It shows that you're working hard, that these facts and emotions did not come without some effort. You will be blessed for this.
Thank you.
Financially, thank you. Somehow. Oh, that was awesome. It's taunting you. Yeah, and he gets sweatier and sweatier. But I was reading some interesting things. I hope that we can talk a little bit too about the just in general how you're blessed, some of these statistics. I'll just throw this in while you're figuring that. I found it very interesting who prays, what religious groups pray the most, and who makes the most in the country. And Jehovah's Witnesses pray the most, which that was one of the most fascinating podcasts you did. It goes Jehovah Witnesses, then Mormons, and then Black Protestants, all the way down to Jewish and unaffiliated pray the least. But when you go to see who makes the average income of these religious groups, Jehovah Witnesses are at the bottom at $24,000, and the Jewish are at the top, $72,000. And it's very reverse how it works. So God has a very interesting way of listening to your financial prayers.
Where are Mormons in this group?
Oh, yeah, it follows along. So the Mormons, they end up kind of in the middle. Let's see, they are right there. So Mormons are in the bottom third of income, and I think that would be a surprise to most Mormons. I think they would say, we're at the top, man.
I would think if you split leaders? Mormons by second-generation Mormons versus first-generation, you'd see a big bifurcation.
You're right. Yeah, that's true.
Because, I mean, Mormon church tends to spread through sort of an immigrant class, right? The first generation. It spreads through lower classes. But people, once they get into the church, adopt oftentimes this
that's
prosperity thinking.
That's a good
thinking.
Point. Yeah. And the Jews aren't Jewish people, are not sending out missionaries to, it's, if you're in the club, you're there, you know, born into it. So that makes sense.
Okay. So let's talk about Mormonism today. We talked about its roots. So prosperity building is still huge. And you brought up the current church leaders, which I really appreciate. The thing that I have that shows this, if you're reading the church news, and I think it's happening spring, when they start putting out the mission president callings.
Yes.
It's fascinating because there's only a few, there's like 100 words, maybe 80 words they have, and what they put in there. So here's a mission president. A high servant of the Lord, what are you going to drop in his 80-word bio? And it's education and career stuff. And one, you know, one's left to ask, if this is a humble servant of the Lord, why is the fact that he went to Vassar and he was on the board of directors at Mars Bars the most important thing to this? But that's what they put in. And there's something that I've noticed that I would love to see somebody do a little bit more research on, which is no matter where I've been in the church authorities, like the high council, the stake presidency, the bishops, tend to come from the wealthiest portions of the stakes.
Right.
And because, and this is ripe for research because the stakes tend to be geographic and the wards do, and they oftentimes tend to cut across boundaries. You know, so if you're in Bountiful, it's a stone's throw from where all the apartments are right there off of I-15 versus the million-dollar homes right on the hill. And sometimes they're in the same ward. And it'd be fascinating to do that research.
I just want to push back on one part. On mission presidents, you know, my concern is that one of the reasons people are getting called to go on missions is because they can afford to go. It's very expensive. It's very difficult for people. They usually require you to have your house paid off. And I mean, it's as a practical reality, people who are having a hard time making ends meet can't afford to go on a mission.
Well, I think it's a really excellent point, Mark. And it begs the question of why this is in Mormonism at all. And when you have a church that's in the frontier and not being born in a city that's been there for 4,000 years, the people who can go out and make their own money on cattle or iron or the railroad or whatever are going to be very valuable to your society. Mm-hmm. And still today in the West, I mean, we're not a grade A economy. This is not Manhattan, right? So the people who can bring the church wealth and prestige and connections and get it what it needs in Washington are going to be very valuable.
Yeah.
Okay. The other example is if you look at any photograph that the church puts out, this is changing a little bit, but especially look in the heyday, in the 70s and 80s, it was always showing an upper middle class white family, in a very beautiful, well apportioned home, you know, with carved furniture and fine art on the walls. And every once in a while we'd have aren't they cute picture of some natives in a hut? But it was always in juxtaposition to the blessed white family, right?
Well, it's the exact opposite now. If you go into the Ensign and look at it, it's this amazing flourish of a mixture that's built up, even while the majority of the leadership, the majority of the church is very white.
It's been, you're right, there has been a change. And some of it, you'll see this sort of, aren't they cute, these brown people trying to act like white people sort of thing. But I think, and we could make the case even today, that when you show pictures of success, they still show a white upper middle class signs and trappings of success.
Yes.
Other things. Utah, when I prepared this presentation, led the nation in oftentimes things that are showy. The Utah led the nation in cosmetic sales, boob jobs, and hair dye sale. Not that there's anything wrong with any of those things, but what it shows is this devotion to appearance, to this outward appearance, and that goes in conjunction with the prosperity gospel.
Utah also leads in bankruptcies currently, one of the highest per capita.
Absolutely.
And in Ponzi schemes.
Yeah.
So those are all there's an interesting correlation there between appearances, people living beyond their means, trying to appear to be perfect, and then getting themselves into financial trouble and turning to fraud, actually.
Absolutely. I want to give one more example. I want to turn back to your idea. And the last example is, who are successful Mormons? And more often than not, we recognize the current church authorities, but if I was to name off a lot of church authorities from the 70s or 80s, even the popular ones, most of you probably wouldn't recognize their names. But the people we know are like Huntsman's and Steve Young's and people who are successful outside of Mormonism. And Mormons tend to see that as vindication. Like if we have one Mormon on Broadway, we think this is the world's going to say that our church is true, forgetting there's 700 other people on Broadway and they're not Mormons. I don't understand this thinking where we have one person in the NFL and we put them on the fireside circuit and tell, invite all your non-members, because yeah, the fact that we have one NFL player suddenly means that we're really successful. All right, so Mark, let's explore your idea a little bit. So we put up all this stuff now we've talked about showing that wealth and the trappings of wealth, the identification of wealth, are all very important for identification of prosperity gospel. That God blesses you and God loves you because God is going to pour out the blessings of heaven. He's going to open the windows so that you can't even receive them all if you are faithful in your stewardship and to your file leaders and your temple covenants. So what happens if you're in a ward with a bunch of upwardly mobile people? And you get passed over a promotion, you're going to start getting passed over promotion in the church too. And there is this definite culture in Utah of driving up further and further trappings of wealth and success to prove and to show that you are righteous. Because if you're righteous, you'll have money. And how many wards have that one guy with the boat and they go down to Lake Powell and that's a really important thing because he's serving the Lord's youth with his boat, right? So God must love him.
One of the things, my brother just moved from Utah to Arizona, and one of the things he's really the happiest about is it's not as competitive. You know, there's a lot of neighborhoods in Salt Lake, in Utah County, Alpine, if anyone lives in Alpine, is ridiculous. North Salt Lake, Bountiful, parts of Bountiful, the upper parts, where, it's very much, very competitive in terms of what size of boat do you have parked outside of your house? How big is your house? How big is your, what BMW do you drive? You know, and there's a lot of pressure on people to keep up with each other. And I think that's driven a lot by this concept of you must be more righteous than me because you have a bigger boat than I do.
Yeah, I think for sure. So let's talk about some of the upsides and downsides of the belief. One of the upsides in the Mormon church is there's a definite noticeable economic lift. Because more successful Mormons are driven into business, and they're driven into accounting, and they're driven into law, and these careers pay more than, say, being an auto body painter.
And my good friend who's here, he's graduated the BYU accounting program. And from what I've understood from him and then checking into it further, it is the program in the nation for accounting. It's built that kind of reputation of being, honest and ethical, but also doing great work in that area.
Yeah. The law school has a huge reputation. Exactly. The business school has a big reputation and I think there's an element of Mormonism that likes these because they're not risky. There's nothing really in the law that's counter to Mormonism, right? It's the law is what the law is, and you either agree with the law or you don't. But you can't say that about like the hard sciences, right? So you know, if you become successful in the hard sciences, you are definitely going to have faith conflict, and the church is going to be suspicious of you. But not if you're just a great lawyer.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so a downside. So that's an upside effect for the church, and you can see it. The church loves ostentatious display. Look at the temples they keep building, and they have mahogany and fine imported teak from who knows where, and whatever they can lay their hands on, they put in those temples, and they love to point it out. When you go on those tours, they'll tell you, this is from the, there's only three of these fucking trees left because we've chopped them all down. And here it is, right here. All right.
So, I want to be on that tour. That's so awesome,
man. The next open house, I'm going to lead a tour, and we're all going to have those little FBI.
Yes. You know what? That
Ogden's
would be great.
Coming
actually,
up.
Why don't you, my little wrist. If you look here, right here, what you're going to see.
Just carry your recorder as you go around. Record your thoughts as you go through.
I am planning.
And then we can all put our sets on and walk through.
I am planning a tour of Salt Lake City Temple, the exterior of the temple. But the church will crack down. So we are looking at hidden mics. I won't say when we're doing it, but look forward to that. All right.
Mike Norton will be filming it.
Mike Norton will be waving us from the windows of the Celestial Room. Okay. So so that's one of the upsides. The economic effect the church has definitely encouraged, and that's why they pour all that money into those schools. The downside is that I believe that this doctrine, this American exceptionalism and this wealth doctrine has a dampening effect on international growth. If you compare Mormons to other churches that are in the same mode, we don't score as well, like in developing nations. And I think that American exceptionalist doctrine really plays out. If you have served in a foreign mission or been with the expats, anywhere in the world, you'll know that a large number of people who attend the Mormon church outside the United States are Amerophiles. They like American culture and they like to be connected to American things. And missionaries know oftentimes their investigators are people who want to like bust out their English on the young Mormon missionaries and talk about America. So that's going to be a dampening effect in places like France, you know, where these young Mormon missionaries are knocking on doors. Ostentatious display of wealth can be a big turnoff for a lot of people. I know I was in San Diego serving my mission when the temple was open, and the church took a lot of heat in San Diego, and it probably had a negative effect on our mission because you have this big temple right there on I-5 when you're up in La Jolla, some of the most expensive real estate on the West Coast, and the church plops down right in the middle of it and says, yeah, We're here. You know, and that was a turnoff to a lot of Californians. I saw firsthand. There were protests and stuff because it was like, what are you doing? What kind of church? You know, we would go out trying to give this message of Jesus Christ and we're all, you know, God's children and we're building this big fucking temple up there. So I think that does backfire. And then we pointed out that when you have the church of money, that people will start trying to manipulate that. You see the rise of MLMs. You see the rise of fraud. Of what's the word for it? The type of fraud that's the most prevalent is Utah affinity fraud. Thank you, Nathan. That's the most prevalent in Utah because they have these tight networks of the ward and this understanding that we should all be rich. We had one of these go through my ward when I was growing up, and that was part of the message. That's how it went through. That God wants you to be blessed. God wants you to have money. God wants you to serve the church. And these confidence men use that belief to spread their fraud.
Can I just chip in here?
Please.
This is a issue that's near and dear to my heart because I'm a lawyer and I specialize in affinity fraud and Ponzi schemes. And so I typically represent, in some cases, I represent the people who perpetrate these schemes. Many of them are bishops. Many of my clients, I've had clients who have been stake presidents, one that was a mission president. And they do absolutely justify their actions in a lot of ways, and it's a longer discussion than we have time for to talk about today. But what I see is that the sad part isn't so much that these people somehow are able to justify their actions because they have a temple recommend. I mean, that certainly happens. In fact, I've had two cases where the perpetrators of the schemes solicited investors in the temple itself. We have a guy, Val Southwick, who was up in Ogden, who ran one of the largest Ponzi schemes in Utah history, who had pictures of himself with prophets and general authorities along the walls of his office. So when people would come in for an investment pitch, he would, you know, show that he had temples and pictures of himself with his arms around various prophets to gain trust. He would use the church directly to gain trust from his victims. He also would use his, if he couldn't close a deal, he would reach in his pocket and pull out his temple recommend and show it to a potential investor in order to gain their trust. And this happens all the time. So I could tell a lot of stories and some of them I can't tell, but I can just say that the sad part though in this state is that there are a lot of members of the church who are overly trusting, because someone is in a position of authority or because someone is simply in their ward. They feel like they must be a good person that they can trust. And so they will invest with them, sometimes their life savings. I've seen cases where people not only invested their entire retirement account, but also took a home equity line on their home and invested all their mortgage into some get-rich-quick scheme that ended up being a Ponzi scheme, and they lost it all. So people in Utah, I think, tend not only to be too trusting, but they also are always looking for a quick buck.
Yeah.
And that is really unfortunate because this is and odd to me because this church has a work ethic that I've always grown up that, you know, you should work hard. But what I'm seeing is that a lot of people feel like they don't need to work for their money. And if they've got some get rich quick scheme, and maybe this comes from the MLM culture, I don't know, but it happens all the time, that people will think that something is a good deal, and put their entire life savings into it. It's really sad. Really, really sad.
My best friend's husband's done like four or five. They've declared bankruptcy, all sorts of things, but the last 10 years of our life, they continue calling us. Hey, you should get in on this. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, we're working right now. You know, my husband's in school. We're working hard to get there, but it's going to take us 10 years. They had this short-sightedness about them. And I think a lot of people do because they just want to be prosperous. You know, they want to have the money right now. They don't have the time to work for it.
And I think that's one of the things that bothers me the most is that when it comes down to the member's looking at it and they see their stake president or somebody who just got mm-hmm. called to a mission, all of this wealth, they're all doing well. What does it say about me who I thought I was a good guy, but I'm driving a crappy car and I don't, how do they afford this? I don't know how they afford this. And you start to feel like you're not doing the right thing spiritually and you're not seeing these things. So when something comes along where there might be this hope and this guy dresses nice and he has this authority. It's like I can finally leapfrog to that. But the fact is that you just don't know people's finances. You don't know what they're really doing. But for me, the problem is that feeling like you're never good enough. It's kind of like the sin part of it financially is if you're not in it, there is something wrong with you.
Yeah. I'll give a example from my personal history. I think it was the first house. We were in Clinton, and the ward was a bunch of older homes were built in the 70s, smaller homes, 1,800 square feet homes. And then there was a newer subdivision where these homes going in were 2,500, 3,000 square feet. So we had this mixed ward. Well, a young kid moved in. He was about 25. He moved into the newer portion. And he was a good-looking kid, and he dressed well, and he was thin. And he got put in the bishopric right away. And of course, for everybody else, they're, like, oh my God, I just got passed by somebody 7 years younger than me, 8 years younger than me. Well, I was a clerk at the time, and it turns out, it comes up later, he just mentioned passing that his parents gifted them the down payment to the house, right? But here's an example where, in my opinion, and I knew the bishop pretty well, that the bishop, believed that he was on the fast track to success. Here he was, this young man. He was living in the more expensive part. He had bought a house. He had a young family going. His wife was a stay-at-home mother. He was filling this role. But not that that young man did anything wrong. There's nothing wrong with his parents giving him money. But because of this culture we live in, it would appear likely that the bishop assumed that he was ahead of the game financially and that he leapfrogged over these other men who were, competing for these positions for righteousness,
And when I was called, before, it's not just inspiration. They call you.
Oh, yes, Bishop D.
they call you to do mine was a phone interview, but basically it was going down education, finances, debt, ambitions, things like that, it wasn't a discussion of leadership or things like that. It was the brass tacks. Now, I guess you could say you don't want a slouch in there. You want to have, I don't know. Maybe you do want a slouch. I'd like to see what that looks like.
You've reminded me that a company I worked with, I worked in the R&D department. We were small and my supervisor, he was 55, 60. And he came in one day and he said, I got the strangest call. It was from Salt Lake City, and they get a call from a secretary. Will you please hold for such and such? I can't even remember what general authority was. He said, the interview lasted about 20 minutes. They talked about nothing but money. They talked about his debt position, his income, his house ownership, how much, they asked him every question. And then a week later, he got the next call where they gave him an actual interview and he was called as mission president. Mm-hmm. But the first call was only about money.
Well, my brother-in-law just got back 2 weeks ago from serving three years as a mission president. He has a Harvard MBA.
He's gold.
He's
golden. That's a golden ticket.
A lot of people think that he's on his way to higher things.
How's his hair?
We'll see. He's got great
hair. Is he 6 foot?
I will say that after serving for 3 years, his hair is a lot more gray.
Oh,
that's a good
thing. Silvering, yeah.
It's silvering,
oh,
definitely.
Man.
Definitely. I'm slower. I'm getting hot.
He's a great guy, and I'm not saying, but he absolutely told me that the biggest concern the church had was his financial situation before he got called as a mission president. But again, I'm going to push back a little bit because there's a practical reason for that.
Oh, yeah.
You can't leave and come back and be in poverty. And that happens. I've had many of my law partners.
They do expect the senior missionaries to do that.
Yes,
they're okay
true.
If they sell their house
that's
and
true.
Go on a mission and come back broke.
And they pay for their
happens.
Own way.
Well, it's
expensive.
Do. It's baked in. I mean, I've said lots of times, the church could overnight increase the lower the cost of the missionary program, increase its effectiveness by just hiring people. You can still give them a calling, pay them, $30,000 a year. You don't pay them a lot. And have them do it full time. And they would be tons more effective. This is the way most churches do this model. This is the way the church does its general authorities, so it's not that foreign.
The problem is they'd all have nervous breakdowns within, it's a very difficult job.
Well, you first of all, you get younger people to do it. Yeah. And this is what they want to do. This is what they're going to do. They're going to move to Kenya and they're going to be missionaries there for 20 years, right? Oh,
yeah. That would work. Are you talking about missionary as opposed to being a mission president?
Well, if you have professionals, then like the mission presidents have to be there because they're really there to hear all the masturbatory confessions and to talk these depressed young men back onto the street, right? If you change the model, you wouldn't. Anyway.
Yeah.
All right. The last thought that I want to give is when you money always has a downside. And you know, the problem we see with our consumerism is there's always post-industrial waste. There's always sludge pits and child labor and fraud and, you know, all sorts of things, international banking and whatever other world evil you can see oftentimes come out from these things. And the same thing happens, you know, from the church. There's a dark side that exists. In Utah, you can see it as an underbelly that in Utah, we have a very pro-business environment. As such, we have some of the largest, like, chemical weapons incinerators and garbage dumps and nuclear waste because we've made it so friendly for business that everybody can send their shit here. And the same thing plays out in the church. When you have a culture of money, and we've talked about some of them, then you have this underside, this dark side of money. And I'm a capitalist. I'm not against money. But that's part of the system and part of what the church fundamentally owns. All right. Any other last thoughts, D? Bishop D?
I enjoyed it. It's fascinating, but I think if people get out there and they start looking at statistics on, when you start to look at how does prayer, how does living a life of religion bless you compared to those who don't, who are not involved in it, it's like that first time you stop paying tithing. For me, it was a moment where I actually thought, this is when it's going to happen, if it happens at all, that my life is going to shatter. And I think by looking, it's helpful for people to look at this and say, you know what? Atheists survive in this world. They make money. They get educations. They do all of these. They can do great things for society. It's not that you have God's favor, because when you put it down and you say, what is it that I did that God gave me favor for? Then why isn't this dude prospering? Why isn't this child, why is this child born in, you know, has no chance in Africa, and I'm this white honky, born in, and I'm just awesome. I don't know where I'm rambling to, but I just think that it is, it's something that people should really look at and study, to just know that you can do these things on your own. You can be prosperous and you can, have finances if that's what you want. And it doesn't take a religion and it doesn't take bowing down to somebody to get that. That's not the key element. The key element is you and your creativity and your ambition.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is Mamie.
Definitely.
I just want to say something that we haven't really talked about the mall and some of the other things that the church has done. But to me, one of the real key issues here is that members watch the church itself. And what does the church do with its money?
Yeah.
And that's the church. What does it do with this money? It buys land. It builds big buildings. I work in a building owned by the church. It builds a $4 billion mall. It buys hunting preserves. It is spending its money on things that are materialistic. What could it do? You know, word on the street is that the church is sitting on $45 billion in their investment portfolio. What good could the church do in this world with that kind of money? I mean, it boggles my mind to think how many missed opportunities there are. So as members, they look at the church as the example. The church isn't spending its money on charity. Why should I? The church is spending its money on acquiring material things. So that's the example that members follow. And that to me is a travesty.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, thanks to everybody for talking about the prosperity gospel, and go out and prosper. Thanks to the audience tonight, and have a great night.
The
Mormon Expression podcast is recorded before a live studio audience in Salt Lake City on Tuesday nights at 6:30. Come join the studio audience, get a chance to meet John and the panelists, and be a part of the show. The Mormon Expression podcast is a production of Whitefields Educational Foundation. Visit our website at whitefieldseducational.org to find out about counseling services or the other initiatives.